From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is now 3 a.m. in Baghdad. Today, the United States attacked key targets in the Iraqi capital with cruise missiles, leaving government buildings in flames, and with its British allies sent troops and artillery fire pouring into southern Iraq. Iraqi TV reported 72 missiles hit Baghdad in the first 24 hours of war. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said today this was just a taste of what's to come. Tonight, On Point, the latest military developments, plus a close examination of the Coalition of the Willing. We begin with a first-hand report from the Iraqi border near Kuwait, where today U.S. Marines streamed north in the first major ground combat of the war. Tony Perry is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times, embedded with the 1st Marine Division. I asked him what he was seeing as the Marines went in.
I'm with the headquarters battalion of the 1st Marine Division, and what I see around me is that the 1st Marine Division has moved into Iraq and is engaging forces of the Iraqi army. This is the first U.S. forces to move into Iraq and the first to engage to fight with the Iraqi army. What is happening here, and it's about 11 o'clock at night, is the night is being lit up by hundreds of artillery shells, U.S. artillery, Marine artillery, and also Marine air power. Jets and Cobra helicopters are attacking Iraqi positions just across the border. Both the Iraqi army and other various anti-aircraft positions and other things that Marines are going to have to move through as they push further into Iraq and, of course, push all the way, if they can make it, all the way to Baghdad.
Tony Perry, then, how deep have they pushed at this point into Iraq, and what's the quality of the Iraqi resistance at this point?
The Iraqi resistance is being referred to as light. The 51st Mechanized Division is down here, has been moved down here from the Baghdad area in the last few days. It is not considered one of their crack divisions. It is not as good as the Republican Guard, for example, although it is a competent division. So opposition is considered light. The fighting is continued even as we speak, and fighting is thought to be potentially heavier as they move up the road into Baghdad. Operation was supposed to start early in the morning. It was moved up earlier because the Iraqis appear to be setting fire to their own oil wells in some sort of scorched earth policy. So the Marines moved much more quickly than they had planned. They brought in heavy artillery that's pounding those positions with howitzers from this side of the border. And they also called in strikes from jets and from Cobra helicopters. And now in the last few hours, ground troops have moved in, and more are going. I think by the morning they will have entered Iraq in multiple positions and engaged the Iraqi army in what is the first big clash, the first clash at all, but certainly a big clash between the U.S. forces and the Iraq army.
Are Marines actually going on foot? Are they driving toward the front? Are they being borne in by helicopter? How's it working?
All the assets are being used. These are mechanized troops. They're going in by Humvee. They're also going in on foot. There are tanks. There are combat engineers. Those are the people that push ahead of the infantry and push away landmines and other barriers. All the assets of the 1st Marine Division, which, as you know, is the largest Marine division and was the first division, first U.S. force to break their Iraqi line 12 years ago in the liberation of Kuwait, all of those assets are being used, increasingly air howitzers from this side, and now ground troops who've entered into Iraq are engaging Iraqi forces. The hope, of course, is for a big victory and also take POWs to send the word out to all the Iraqi forces that they can surrender, they'll be treated humanely, and if they engage with U.S. forces, there's only one way out if they fight, and that is to die. So that surrender is a far better alternative. That's the message that the Marines want to send after this skirmish is over.
Tony Perry, from your position, can you see return fire from the Iraqi side? Return artillery fire, missiles, you name it.
There has been report of some attempts of that, but there is not a lot of that. We scan the horizon all the way from left to right, east to west, and there's just a myriad of explosions, but all of them seem to be going north, going towards Iraq. There doesn't seem to be that kind of opposition that you might consider or that is occurring apparently in Baghdad. So, no, there doesn't seem to be a lot of return fire. But, of course, those positions have been softened up by the howitzers before the ground troops went in, and they've been softening them up for hours. So if there had been something there, it's probably gone by now. There were launches of some sort of missiles into Kuwait today. The number I hear is 4. Some of them may have been knocked down by Patriot missiles. One made it all the way almost to Kuwait City and hit the desert harmlessly, but was aimed apparently at Camp Commando, which is the Marine command post that they established back in November. But again, it landed harmlessly in the desert. No one was injured, but it did send a chill through all the troops here and kept all the troops in their nuclear, biological, chemical warfare suits and gas masks on and off all day.
And Tony, from your position also, can you see any evidence of oil well fires, of oil fields set alight, smoke or anything else?
That's hard to say. There are some lights in the far, far distance that could exactly be that. But that's always hard to say with the Iraqis because they burn their oil wells at night anyway. They burn off the gas. It's an inefficient way they have of pumping oil and leads to this gas that they burn off. There are reports from the Marines that they have set a fire some of their oil wells, and that is among other reasons why the 1st Marine Division has moved in as quickly as it has.
You mentioned Baghdad as their target, of course. Between where you are and Baghdad is Basra. Is the 1st Marine Division bypassing Basra? Do they intend to take Basra on their way? What's your understanding?
Well, the 1st Marine Division, while it is the largest Marine group here, is not the only group here. There is also the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit from Camp Pendleton, who have combined with the Royal Marines and have the Basra territory as their responsibility. The 15th MU, as they call it, and the Royal Marines have Basra as a responsibility, although they have not, to my knowledge, launched any sort of offensive yet in that area.
And still aircraft overhead as well, Tony, or is it all artillery at this hour?
It's a combination of both. The skies are pretty full with all sorts of aircraft, the Cobra helicopters, the what are probably F-18s, there might be Harrier jump jets up there. The whole skies are full with the whole Marine arsenal. And then, of course, the howitzers, and they've been arrayed along the border for some days, are pounding the Iraqi positions just continuously. It's one burst after another. They don't just hit a position with one howitzer. They hit it with multiple shots from multiple howitzers. That way the enemy doesn't know where it's coming from, can never track it very well, so he can't mount, if he has the capability, any sort of defensive or countermeasures at all. So everything, as far as we know, is still in play, and everything is being used in this offensive. Howitzers on the ground, air power above, and the infantry moving quickly to overtake this 51st Mechanized Division of the Iraqi Army.
Tony Perry, thanks for joining us. Be safe.
My pleasure. I will.
Tony Perry is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times, embedded with the 1st Marine Division. He spoke with us from the Kuwait-Iraq border. We are looking tonight at the opening day of war, what it has accomplished, and what it may tell us about the road ahead. And we're taking a hard look at what President Bush today called the ever-growing coalition of the willing, and asking what's real and what's fluff in the 40-something lineup of nations that includes the United States and El Salvador. Are events in Gulf War II unfolding as you expected? Are you shocked and awed yet? Do you feel better knowing that Bulgaria is on America's team? Is this coalition real? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Tad Olstrom. He now directs the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening. Good to have you back, General Olstrom.
Thanks, Tom.
And in the studio tonight, Daryl Press, Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, who for the past 8 years has served as a consultant to the U.S. Defense Department for military planning in the Persian Gulf. Daryl Press, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
We have a lot to talk about tonight. We'll get to the Coalition of the Willing, but before we do, I want to look at today's events. General, as you look across this combination of things, and I guess the big elements are here, continuing bombardment of Baghdad over a new night, and the push in from the south, from Kuwait into Iraq. Is this what was expected? Are we on plan? Are we on track? In your estimation, how are things going in this opening day?
Well, let's start with whether it's on plan or not. I think most people and certainly the media included, would have anticipated the first thing we would have seen would be the shock and awe.
The big boom.
The big boom. And when we saw this happen, the first strike, literally an hour before daylight, we all sat back and said, how could this be, the shock and awe, with
is
only
that all
an
there
hour
is?
Of night left? And then it stopped. And as we reflected upon it, it made lots of sense that it was a target of opportunity strike, which in my mind reflects the real change in our technology capability from what we saw in Desert Storm.
Which is going after a leadership bunker, we're told.
No, it's not that as much as it's the ability to be able to identify a target, plan and program to strike that target, especially with the Tomahawk missiles that, under the old navigation scheme, almost days required in order to reprogram a missile
to strike.
Mm-hmm. Now we can do this in a matter of hours and even less.
So kind of pinpoint strike on very short notice.
On very short notice.
We don't know exactly what happened there, if leadership was disrupted. We are seeing stories. The Associated Press is reporting that sources saying that the Iraqi forces are in disarray, that it looks like no one, including Saddam Hussein himself, is in overall command of Iraq's security or military operations. It's an intelligence report saying there's been no coordinated response to American attacks either in Baghdad or in the rest of the country. Does that say to you, General Ulstrom, that strike early Iraq time was successful, or this is just the chaos of war?
That tells me that there's information out there that all should be suspect at
yes,
this point.
All right.
But I think we can make some sense out of a decision that it sounds like is coming out of the administration that we're going to hold back on this shock and awe piece, which indicates to me that they want to make sure they have a good assessment of the impact of at least that first strike, which was aimed at leadership, and maybe the follow-on strikes, which I'm not so sure we know exactly what the target within the complex was. And if indeed there's a chance that we can avoid a shock and awe, which will include significant damage to the infrastructure, then we ought to take a look at that.
That's what I was feeling today, Daryl Press. Donald Rumsfeld, again this morning, in his press conference, driving home the kind of message we've heard again and again, that this U.S. assault, the shock and awe assault, would be, quote, of a force and scope and scale that is beyond what has been seen before in all of history. Trying to say, hey, put your arms down so we don't have to do this. Do you sense this same thing? The U.S. trying to spare Iraqi infrastructure, spare Iraqi civilians, win without the huge barrage?
I think it's absolutely true, and that's why you've seen the majority of the air attacks in Baghdad on the first, I guess, 18 hours focused on strategic attacks, which were, as the general said, against leadership bunkers, but also against communication sites with the goal of separating any surviving leadership from their military forces.
And the ground invasion from Kuwait, as expected, successful. How does it look to you from what we know?
Well, I think it's too early to know how well it's going. I think it does make a lot of sense to kick off a ground invasion almost immediately once the air attacks start, because I think that no matter what plays out in Baghdad, the military wants to get serious numbers of U.S. forces to the outskirts of Baghdad as soon as possible.
Feet on the ground near or at the capital's door?
At least outside the city, in case stability missions are required, in case there are people who momentarily want to turn over control of the city, in case the refugee situation gets very serious and we want to be able to distinguish between senior members of the regime who are fleeing versus just normal civilians. So I think for a variety of reasons that we're really trying to get ground forces quickly to the outskirts of the city.
And you've got to push in to do that. You can't just fly everybody north on big helicopters?
Baghdad's more than 250 miles from Kuwait, and so at least basing this off of what we did in the Gulf War, it's probably going to take a couple different jumps using helicopters and setting up possibly logistics bases within Iraq before we can get serious forces through helicopter assault to the outskirts of Baghdad.
Jack Beatty, the theater of war is set, and the rumble is underway. Artillery, the bombs over Baghdad, the works, but not shock and awe.
Yeah, and I'm a little heartened by what the general just said about perhaps even giving a second thought to shock and awe, because, of course, that's the kind of thing that just if it is the worst bombardment in history, that's not a public relations coup, to put it mildly. And even if every building it strikes is a government building, even if every person it kills is a member of the Ba'ath Party, which is unlikely, it's still going to look terrible. The rubble will look appalling. And our enemies are going to be able to make a field day out of that. And so if they are giving some second thought to that, maybe they can get the psychological advantage of it. It could come, beware, and use this this pinpoint bombing to cut off to break the communications and maybe get the same effect from it.
It may be exactly what they have in mind. We're talking about war in earnest tonight, and coming up, taking a closer look at what George Bush calls the coalition of the willing. Is this war unfolding as you expected? Are you shocked and awed yet? Are we better off without that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are tracking the latest developments in the war with Iraq tonight and examining what President Bush today called the ever-growing coalition of the willing. The president says that over 40 nations now support U.S. efforts. We are asking, who are these nations and what kind of support are they giving? Is this coalition real and important, or just window dressing on a unilateral offensive? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guest in the studio tonight, General Tad Olstrom, director of the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Daryl Press, professor of government at Dartmouth College, who for the past 8 years has been a consultant to the Defense Department on military planning for the Persian Gulf. Earlier today, at a Pentagon press briefing, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld criticized those who have said that the U.S. is going it alone against Iraq.
This is not a unilateral action, as is being characterized in the media. Indeed, the coalition in this activity is larger than the coalition that existed during the Gulf War in 1991.
Secretary Rumsfeld, earlier today, we're talking tonight about what George Bush and the Secretary call the coalition of the willing. I'm joined now from New York by Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and current Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening and welcome, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Lawrence Korb, sit back and look at this. It's easy to throw jibes at a coalition of the willing that includes Azerbaijan and Estonia and Latvia and say, you know, what is this? But you tell us, what is this coalition? How does it differ from the first Gulf War coalition, and does the difference matter?
Well, I think it differs a great deal, because in the first Gulf War, we had almost 300,000 fighting troops from other nations, and literally hundreds of airplanes were contributed by other nations. And they were also nations in the area. I mean, you got a lot of support from the Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Syria, Egypt, all sent troops. Here you have countries that really don't have much of an interest in this area, which are signing up more or less to get on the side of the United States, or to get in the United States' good graces, and making literally, other than the British, just token contributions. I guess the Australians too are making it.
2,000 Australian
right,
troops.
Right, and making token contributions. You also have the matter of money. In the last war, we actually made a profit. We collected the money from the other nations based upon the fact we thought the war would last 3 months and only lasted roughly about 40 days.
But we were passing the hat to big, rich nations.
Right, we were. We got a lot from obviously the countries in the region. We also got significant amounts from Germany and Japan. So I think there's a very, very big difference here, both in terms of the quality of the contributions as well as the monetary contributions that we got.
So is this a kind of insult to the intelligence of American citizens and the world to go on and on about this coalition? Or is it important in spite of the fact that the ranks are filled here with, you know, El Salvador, Uzbekistan, Iceland, Ethiopia?
Well, I think it's an attempt by the administration to have it both ways. They did not want to work with the Security Council and to allow the Security Council to make the decision. And so they're trying to say, well, even though we didn't do that, you know, we still have the support of a lot of countries in the world. It's just like if you look at the reasons that they have for going to war, they have some good reasons, but they have a lot of reasons that just don't make sense, and they keep sort of adding them on and undermining their own case. So I think that's really what you have there. This is a White House's very controlled message and wants to put out you know, the best face on everything. An example with the tax cut. To listen to on the tax cut, you think he was going to go to all the people on welfare, when in fact the majority is going to go to, you know, people making in the, you know, the top 1% of the income.
General Ostrom, let me put it to you. You're the military man. You can look down this list as well as we can and see some nations on here that make a big difference, the United Kingdom. But after that, Macedonia, small countries, El Salvador, is this important? Is this propaganda? Is it important propaganda?
The answer is it is important propaganda. I think it's important for countries that are willing to put their name with this coalition. That is a significant thing in itself. Talking about the military aspect, though, I think it's worthwhile to at least consider that it would be very, very difficult with this concept, this plan that we have to use military force to incorporate militaries from most countries. So I'm not so sure there wasn't a reason not to push too hard to get military direct contributions. We would love to have the dollars that we had back in the Desert Storm period, but we have had, I think, wonderful cooperation in terms of overflight rights, landing rights, movement of forces in and out logistically. But I think we need to consider how much we really wanted to have more military contributions.
Are you suggesting that for a hyperpower United States, this kind of coalition with token coalition partner involvement is actually more efficient than having real substantial forces on board? France had something like 20,000 troops involved last time. Are you saying, General Ostrom, the U.S. is better off materially in the war without that?
Maybe in a direct military efficiency sense. Obviously, the picture is much broader than that on bringing folks along in a coalition. I think Daryl had some comments along that. Daryl?
I did. I think that critics who say that this coalition is merely symbolic miss the point that the general is making, which is that, frankly, from a military sense, all of our coalitions are largely symbolic. Even the coalition in 1991, if you think about the countries whose military forces contributed in a significant way to the fighting, it was basically the United States and Britain. The French had a small ground force there, which was put off in the western Iraqi desert, not given very much to do. So, yes, this, most of our allies this time are symbolic. They usually are, although I do think there is something very significant about what Mr. Korb said, which is there is the money, and this time we're going to end up paying for it. And the second thing is that there does feel like there's something different this time. Many of our key allies in the region are only giving us grudging and limited support.
I mean, and there are no Arab nations publicly on the list.
That's exactly it. The Turks now give us some grudging overflight rights, but even there we can't even land the tankers on Turkish air bases, so it's going to complicate things. The Saudis and the Jordanians, who I think everybody believes are giving us support, won't publicly admit that they're giving us support. So I think Mr. Korb is right. There is a big difference. On the other hand, it's also true that ultimately what this is about is symbolism, because we probably don't need, and in a military sense, I think that's right, probably don't want that much interference with the operations.
Jack Beatty, Micronesia reportedly joined the list today. Is this credible symbolism, or is this the United States, tooting a horn that doesn't honk, whatever?
Well, you know, it's incantatory. We're trying to, with the very phrase, we're trying to will something into existence that isn't there. It's a little bit like Mr. Bush saying we're doing this to keep the peace. Well, that's Orwellian. We're beginning a war. And some people even think the phrase weapons of mass destruction is not really very lucid, that only properly applies to nuclear weapons. But I do think the very fact that they have to keep coming back to coalition is also sending a message to the American public. According to the latest poll, the poll just before the war began, only 47% of the public, 47% of the public would support this war only with multilateral UN coalition in a meaningful sense backing. And for all the talk about, you know, it's the unipolar world, and we've heard from people on this program, the United States has got to do it alone and so on. The American people still think, no, even if it's only symbolic, we have to be with other nations, because that shows that we're part of the world. We're not the colossus looming over the planet. We represent something more than what's inside our borders.
Lawrence Korb, what about it? We understand the material country contributions, such as they may be, we understand the intended symbolism of this coalition and the White House pointing out every growth of a country or two in the length of the list. But how does the symbolism really work here? You know, of course, today the United States remains under attack by France, by Russia, saying this is wrong, wrong, wrong what you're doing. It's not legal. It's not within a proper multilateral context. Is this a credible response to that critique?
Well, I don't think it's credible. It may be credible in some people's eyes. But, you know, I think the general's right. We don't really need a lot of military contributions. But if you look at what happened in Afghanistan, we had something like 90 nations provided some form of support. We really didn't need it. But NATO invoked Article 5. The UN authorized it. That was a truly multilateral operation. And you've seen after we got rid of the Taliban, you have an international security assistance force, which was commanded successfully by British, Turkish, and now German and Danish generals. And I think that's really the multilateral effort. The Persian Gulf would be, back in 91, would be close to that, and this would be, you know, further down the spectrum. I think the United States wants to have it both ways, or the Bush administration, I should say, wants to have it both ways. They want to show that they are working with the rest of the world, even though they're going to do what they want. And their message is, you know, you need us more than we need you. If you want to come along with us, fine, but we, you know, really don't need you.
Ari Fleischer saying today, every major race, religion, and ethnic group in the world is represented in this coalition. That the coalition, he says, represents about 1.18 billion people from countries with a combined gross domestic product of 21.7 trillion. I mean, they're doing everything they can to portray this as a substantial portion of the world rallying behind the effort. We understand the advantage of portraying it that way, but is this the real deal? Alex is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. The so-called coalition of the willing are really a joke because half of the coalition countries are poor and recipient of U.S. aid. For instance, Ethiopia, Eritrea. They have their own problems, starvation, AIDS, and I don't understand why even they are behind this war.
Are you from Ethiopia,
yes,
Alex?
Yes, I am.
Well, are you on board? Are you behind the war? Not that every citizen of Ethiopia need be for them to be a coalition partner, but are you?
Unfortunately, I am not, because I don't think it really justifies. Because if it justified, you will see the whole United Nations, the whole country will be behind this. United States is just going it alone and rallying all these poor countries for just the propaganda purposes. I don't think it's really the way to go. And unfortunately, they are there, and the people from here have to support them too because their sons and daughters are right out in the field.
So it doesn't persuade this Ethiopian. Alex, thank you very much for calling. Joe's calling. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to draw attention to one point that's often overlooked in these discussions about if this coalition's real or, you know, or fictional, and that's that the peoples of even the countries that are nominally on the coalition list don't support this war. That in, you know, Great Britain, we've heard, you know, that there's large majorities against the war and that Tony Blair's almost being thrown out of power for supporting it. In you know, we know about France and Germany, but even in Italy, you know, have millions of people in the streets, you know, protesting the war. And I think that if we're going to talk about this as being a war that the world community supports, we need to look at the people, not just the elites of a select few countries or the elites of countries that we can strong-arm easily like we can El Salvador, you know, offer a little bit of aid or offer a little bit of a threat to remove aid, and you've got the elite on board. But the people are harder to convince, and the Bush administration, despite all its propaganda efforts, has not been able to do that. And so, I mean, I think that's an important part, if, you know, that has to be in this discussion. If we're going to, you know, a real coalition of the world community would have to represent the people, not just a select few people in a select few countries.
Got it, Joe. Thanks for calling. I think we've got the point there. And even the elites have been resisting in some quarters. Lots of relatively small emerging democracies on this list, one of them Croatia, conditioned its airspace access on further support from its parliament and UN approval. U.S. ambassador to Croatia came down like a ton of bricks. Ambassador Lawrence Rawson told the independent weekly Globus there, "We're talking about war and peace. However, your government has decided to shirk its responsibility and play a reserved role." Lawrence Korb, we understand the need for a coalition, but does this end up being an effective device for the U.S. long term, or is it transparently something less than that?
I think it's transparently something less than that, and it gives us the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, they ought to be honest about it. The United States has good reasons for doing it, but to pretend that the rest of the world supports them is simply not true. And I think even the countries who disagree with us would respect us more if we were honest about it and gave the reasons. I mean, if you look at the talk that Colin Powell gave when he was talking to the Security Council, he came up with a couple of intelligence assumptions about nuclear weapons and stuff coming from uranium from Niger, and it turned out not to be true. I mean, he didn't even need that for his case. But, I mean, that's what I think really annoys a lot of people around the world, because they look at this and they say, you know, it really isn't. Admit what it is. It's the United States and the British wanting to deal with a problem because they feel that the world will be better off and their security will be enhanced.
Darrell Press, though, is it that simple? If you were king of the world or president of the United States, would you duck having as big a coalition on paper as you could? I mean, it must be perfectly tempting to wrap that list of putative allies around your shoulders.
Absolutely. Proponents of this approach will call this a symbolic coalition, and opponents of it will call it a propagandistic coalition, but it's the same thing. I think the real point is this, in my mind. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration knows very, very well how much animosity and skepticism there is in the Arab world toward this. They know very well, exactly as the previous caller said, that the public in many of the countries that support us are strongly skeptical of this. They understand this. But their position and their idea is the following. They say nothing succeeds like success, mm-hmm. and that if the war goes the way they expect, and if the casualties are few, and if the Iraqi civilian losses are minor, and if they can put together an Iraqi state that's much better after the war than it was beforehand, then the skepticism will die out and they will be proven right. And that's what they're hoping.
So climb on board, everybody. Here we go. Siddiqui's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Yeah, I was calling in about the war and the coalition of the wilting. And I want the coalition piece, I think, is a joke. I mean, I expect Fleischer to name Gilligan's Island tomorrow as the 41st member. But in regards to the war, you know, I hear comments about they're expecting, you know, 3 days of bombardments. Mm-hmm. And I believe the United States, I'd like to hear from your guests their opinion on this, that I believe they made some tactical errors. In Desert Storm, there was a situation where they fought in the desert and the Iraqi troops were out in the open, and so the expectation was going to be three days of bombing, and then there'd be thousands of Iraqi troops with their hands over their heads saying they give up. But what happened was that with the 500 media people there who have been embedded and traveling, I believe the Bush administration came to the realization, well, wait a minute now, people are seeing this war on TV every hour. And if we carpet bomb Baghdad, which I think they wanted to do initially, I think that's the primary reason why they tried to change their strategy, that they wanted to carpet bomb. But what happened was that based on the media there and this country being accused of, well, look, this is about genocide and killing women and babies. If you carpet bomb, then that's the perception that's going to be out there. So I think that they made the determination that they're going to select targets right now. But what it is, if I'm Saddam, I'm feeling pretty good right now, because his strategy is to draw the ground troops into the cities and go, you know, street by street.
So, Dickie, we've got the perspective. Our time's running out before the break. I'm not sure I'm quite that jaundiced that the U.S. would like to carpet bomb Baghdad. There's no evidence of that at this point, but we're talking about it. We'll be back to talk about it. We're looking at war in earnest tonight and taking a closer look at what George Bush calls the coalition of the willing. Is this war unfolding as you expected? And does the phrase coalition of the willing give you comfort or stick in your craw? Is this a real coalition as advertised, or a useful figment of propaganda? And does it matter that the armed heart of the coalition is the U.S., the U.K., and a couple thousand Aussies? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war in earnest and taking a closer look at the coalition of the willing. Is this war unfolding as you expected? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight in the studio, General Tad Olstrom, now director of the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Darrell Press, professor of government at Dartmouth College for the past 8 years, a consultant to the Defense Department on military planning for the Persian Gulf. And Lawrence Korb, with us from New York, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, current Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and our own Jack Beatty. General Ulstrom, we had a caller just before the break, very cynical about everything going on here from the U.S. military front. But it seems to me that the military has been talking and planning and developing technology that makes carpet bombing really something out of history. In fact, beyond, and I'd like you to comment on that. And beyond that, you mentioned the other night that the military may even be uncomfortable with scenes of grave destruction of the Iraqi military, a la the famous Highway of Death, where hundreds and hundreds of charred vehicles and bodies of the Iraqi army were left completely destroyed on their way out of Kuwait in Gulf War I. What's your sense of how the military is trying to handle the destructive power of its own armed forces?
Well, certainly the concept of shock and awe in some people's mind may be a carpet bombing type approach, but it is anything but that. With the preciseness of weapons and realizing not all of them are perfect, but the percentages are very, very high, we are very comfortable as a military to be able to strike the target that we're aiming at. Hopefully they're all the right targets.
Mm-hmm.
So carpet bombing is not a term that we would even be considering. And certainly the targets that we are going after would be struck by and large with precision-guided munitions, and technology has done a terrific thing for it.
And what about this issue of unleashing that power on Iraqi troops themselves? Is it possible that the U.S. military this time might consider even scenes of destruction of Iraqi military to be a public relations problem? Or is that just beyond what the military's paid to think about?
No, I think they must think about that. And I brought it up the other night that created a scenario, maybe not unlike we saw the return of the Iraqi troops out of Kuwait as they were racing back up towards Baghdad trying to save as much equipment as possible. And the fact that this could be related to maybe an early strike in the Basra area with large numbers of Iraqi forces at some point in time under direction to try to get back up on the highway and run to Baghdad, forcing us into a situation not unlike the Highway of Death. And I think there's a consideration there that what do we do and how far do we press that and who's watching?
Vince is calling from Washington, North Carolina. Hi, Vince. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Good to have you.
Couple of things. Since the beginning, the United Nations has been very, very ineffective.
Mm.
And we really have been the backbone of the United Nations. This coalition that they've got going, whether they're little countries or not,
mm-hmm.
doesn't really make any difference. I just hope that the politicians in years to come, when Turkey and other countries ask for aid, remember this.
Who was on the list? Who stood up with the U.S. and who didn't?
Yes, that's right. That's important. And, you know, the United Nations, it's just a joke. It really is. It has been from the very beginning.
So there it is. Vince, we've got it. Daryl Press, basically, you know, coalition schmoalition is the message here. Even the UN is coalition isn't impressing Vince. Can we look at things that way? General Ulstrom says in military terms, we can. Perhaps we're even better off. But how important is it in the largest strategic sense for the U.S., even in its most tightly defined national interests, let alone global interests, to have that big penumbra of other countries' names alongside?
I think in a broader strategic sense, having the trust and confidence of our allies around the world is very, very important for the United States. The war on Iraq is important, but arguably the war on terrorism is even more important. And the war on terrorism cannot be fought successfully without the active cooperation and participation of friends of the United States in the Arab world and the Muslim world and in Europe. So for the reason of the war on terrorism itself, I think it's very important that we still have the trust and support of our allies. Also, America has strategic interest all around the world, in East Asia, for instance, and appearing to be reasonable and listening to our allies will be very important, regardless of how we try to settle this North Korean problem.
But also to Vince's point, is it possible that the United Nations may no longer be the best vessel for delivering that coalition of support?
Well, I think in a way we're both asking too much of the United Nations and also giving the United Nations too little credit. I think what was proven in the last few weeks is that the United Nations does not have the ability to constrain the world's most powerful country in the world from doing something that it very badly wants to do. But frankly, that's not news. That shouldn't make us throw out the baby with the bathwater. The UN does all sorts of very helpful things in the world. It's a great forum for coordinating foreign policies, for coordinating aid programs, for coordinating peacekeeping, etc. So it can't do everything. It can do some things. Mm.
Vince, thanks for your call. Ali's calling from Boston. Hi, Ali. You're on the air. Hello, Ali. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry I didn't.
Not at all. What's on your mind tonight, Ali?
What I wanted to say is that I hear a lot of people calling and criticizing the government, criticizing the president.
Well, I think we're getting it both ways here tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm Iranian, and I was almost drafted into the war for the 1980-88 war.
The Iraq-Iran war.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And this person, this Saddam Hussein, and I'm not saying only Saddam Hussein, even the government of Iran, about 1 million people died on both sides during that war. And a lot of my friends call me and they say, oh, are you okay? We're praying for you. Well, you know, I'm good and dandy. And actually, there are a lot of people in Iran jumping up and down, and they can't wait until the same thing happens to Iran, until the government is overthrown there.
So you're saying bravo for this push into Iraq and bring it on to Iran?
Absolutely. They're just a bunch of thugs that took over the government, and they just kill the people, and they don't even care about anybody. The government in these two countries and a bunch of other countries, they have no legitimacy to be in power, and I'm not in a position or anything. I'm just a regular guy that just left the country, wanted a better life, and came here.
Ali, we've
and
got it. Hang on. I want to put that to Lawrence Korb. What do you say, Lawrence Korb? Here's the common man from Iran saying, you go, George Bush, with whatever coalition you've got. Kick him out of Baghdad and come on to Iran.
Well, there's an awful lot of evil in the world, and there's a lot of, you know, people that are suffering. It would be great if they could all have the same freedoms that we have in the United States. But the United States just doesn't have the power to do all that, and if it begins to take on all of those responsibilities, the people here at home are going to get what Stanley Hoffman, the professor at Harvard, calls battle fatigue. In terms of then not really supporting what are our vital interests. And I think in this debate about going to Iraq has been, from a realist point of view, not a pacifist point of view, where people opposed to war, saying, you know, what is your main priority now in terms of dealing with threats to your national security? And a lot of people would put dealing with al-Qaeda first, North Korea second, before they would want to deal with Iraq. And, you know, when the president gave his Axis of Evil speech and talked about Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, a lot of people around the world said, well, gee, if we support you in Iraq, are you going to go to Iran next and then and North Korea? And where does it stop?
And there's no promise that he won't.
There isn't. I mean, I think if you go back and you take a look at Vietnam, I remember when I was a young person in the Navy, when I went over there, I remember seeing the sign. It said, you know, today you're fighting for Saigon, so you won't have to fight for San Francisco, you know, tomorrow. Well, I mean, that simply wasn't true, but that's what we thought. And it's the same way here. It would be great if we got rid of evil and if all of the countries in the world had the same freedoms we do. But it's not something, you know, we can accomplish, and I think we have to learn to live with a lot of these regimes, and we make common cause with them. I mean, after all, look at some of the countries that joined the coalition we talked about before. Mm. Look at what we've done in terms to get Pakistan support to deal with the situation in Afghanistan. If I'm worried about a terrorist giving a nuclear weapon, a country giving a nuclear weapon to a terrorist, I put Pakistan way ahead of Iraq. But yet we have to deal with Pakistan because we need their help in other areas. And I think this is something you have to recognize in dealing with international politics and not let your rhetoric, you know, carry you away so that you begin to give false hope to people that you really can't fulfill.
But what about the Madeleine Albright line? What's the point of this great big military if we don't use it?
Well, again, there's a limit. I mean, it's a terrific military. It's the best in the world. But, I mean, for example, if we have to put, as General Shinseki, the chief of staff of the Army, said, 200,000 people to occupy Iraq, mainly Army people, well, the Army only has 10 active divisions, and if you're rotating, and boy, you're going to tie down a large percentage of your army that will not be available if something, for example, would happen on the Korean Peninsula.
It's a complicated situation. Lawrence Korb, it's always great to have you, and thank you for joining us from New York tonight.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Korb is Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And Ali, thanks for your call. General Alston, bring us back into the fight that's going on right now. We talked earlier about how perhaps there's the hope in the military that the big bang, the shock and awe doesn't have to come. But the other phrase we've heard a lot of today is preparing the battlefield, that these are early strikes intended to soften up, position Iraqi forces for the bigger strike to come. Can you see that outline here as well?
Well, in fact, we have seen the prepping of the battlefield ongoing now really for months, and certainly within the last few weeks, the increased number of strikes in our no-fly zone was certainly meant to do just that, to prep the battlefield. There has been a considerable movement, I believe, of some Iraqi forces, maybe sporadic, but a considerable movement that will need some attention as the ground forces move forward. And certainly the capabilities embedded within, especially our air mobile forces, have the capability to take care of much of that. Mm-hmm. So prep of the battlefield I don't see as being a huge piece. My own personal opinion is that we could go across that border any time we want to in considerable and a considerable speed.
Well, and of course, we are, as we heard earlier in the hour, we are across that border at this point. But is this the main ground invasion that we've already seen today, Del Press? Can you tell from the reports that are so far out of that area? We have U.S. Marines across the border in force, we're told, British forces on the Alfa Peninsula that goes up to Basra that has a lot of Iraqi oil on it, reports of four or five Iraqi oil wells perhaps on fire. Is this the main invasion, or is this still probing?
Well, I think the way to address this is to think about the major operations that U.S. and British ground forces are going to have to accomplish in order to win this war if airstrikes don't somehow eliminate the regime. And I think those operations are controlling southern Iraq, which is what you see starting to happen now, seizing and developing forward operating bases halfway up Iraq, dealing with enemy prisoners of war, assisting refugees, and then finally advancing on Baghdad. And then the final big question is whether or not there has to be an operation on Baghdad itself. You can see that we're already starting to do some of these things. We're already starting to try to get control of southern Iraq. There's all kinds of snippets of intelligence that say that we're doing things to prepare air bases within Iraq. And so I think it's getting going, but we still have a ways to go.
How much longer can they hold off the big light show, the big shock and awe bombardment in hopes of defections and crumbling in the Iraqi military? Do they have to deliver that at some point if they don't see the military just giving way?
I don't think they have to deliver it. I agree with the comments made earlier that it's very prudent of them to let the dust settle after this first round of strategic attacks on Baghdad, because who knows, maybe they got lucky and maybe they were good and maybe they already disintegrated the regime. But whether they're paused or whether they're attacking Baghdad, I think very quickly and maybe already they'll start moving heavy ground forces and air assault ground forces toward Baghdad to bring this to a close one way or another.
And very quickly, General Alston, final question. Scud attacks on Kuwait today. Despite all that earlier softening up and bombardment, were you surprised? And if they can launch from there, could they still launch from the Scud box over near Israel at Israel?
I was not surprised at all that there were Scuds launched. Our intelligence all along has been saying that there were residual Scud capabilities within the Iraqi
despite all
forces.
The surveillance, all the flyovers?
In spite of all of that, and the fact that they could have been hidden for all this time was certainly one of those things that was reasonable to think through. So it did not surprise me. The fact that we have seen some today isn't necessarily an indicator how many are left. And that is a concern because we obviously, as we start moving forces forward, need to be considered with where they're going to come together and whether or not they're vulnerable to Scuds as they get closer to Baghdad.
General Ted Alston, now Director of National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, great to have you with us tonight. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Daryl Press, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Daryl Press is Professor of Government at Dartmouth College and for 8 years has been a consultant to the Defense Department on military planning for the Persian Gulf. Well, Jack Beatty, it is rolling straight forward here.
Yes, and there are men and women doing the rolling. Recently, the town of Beelsville, Ohio, which lost more young men per capita than any place in the nation in Vietnam, had a big parade to support our troops, and a local resident delivered this line: "Now our children, husbands, wives must pay a price so steep to stop these monsters in their tracks so we may freedom keep."
And on the other side of that line, Iraqi children as well. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.